I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. Welcome to Season 3. In 1985, a horrific double homicide shattered the small town of Waverly, Georgia. The murders of Harold and Thelma Swain stunned the community and law enforcement, and despite their best efforts, the case remained unsolved for years. The arrest and conviction of Dennis Perry should have solved the case and given them closure, but was the case really solved? And this week, I feel lucky because to kick off this season, I've got the whole undisclosed team. We've got Colin Miller, Associate Dean and Professor of Law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at the Evidence Plof Brog.
Exactly right.
Ladies and gentlemen, Colin Miller. We also have with us Rabia Chowdhury. She's the author of Adnan's Story and the host of the 45th podcast. Welcome to the show, Rabia.
Hey, John.
Also, we have Susan Simpson. She's an associate of the Volkov Law Group, but also a host of the 45th podcast. Welcome to the show, Susan Simpson.
Hello, John. I'm down here in Camden County.
Oh, you're in situ. You're oh my God. Well, oh my gosh. I actually did want to ask you about that because you grew up in Floyd County. Am I correct?
Yes.
So does that perspective?
No. I grew up in Atlanta.
Oh, you grew up in Atlanta. Oh,
my family's from Floyd.
Got it. But you had some experience of it as a child?
Yeah,
is that correct?
I knew it pretty well.
Okay, so I'm not crazy. I'm not just making stuff up. Susan grew up in the wilds of Tennessee. No, it's not. but now, is that giving you perspective on this town of Waverly?
I mean, for Camden County, my familiarity with it mostly consisted of driving down 95 to get to Florida.
So you passed through it,
yes,
by and large.
I mean, north, as a kid, we went to Jekyll Island a lot, which is just north in like Linn County. So I've been in the area, but in terms of Camden County, and especially out in the rural areas, no, I'd never been here before.
So it's all new to you as well, to some degree.
It is. Well, sometimes I'll admit it kind of feels like Floyd County with swamps.
Okay, that should be their tourist slogan, you know, Floyd County, but with swamps.
I was wondering the same thing. I was wondering how it compares to Floyd County. Is it a bigger county, smaller county, more diverse? Like, what's the deal? More small town.
It's about the same size, I think, but instead of having like one big town that kind of covers the whole territory, you've got a few more different sort of urban areas across the county and a lot more empty space.
This is one of the first times that we've done an episode that really seemed to center around an episode of television. I know we talked about the Deadly Whitman episode in the Pam Lanier case, but this one seems really to revolve around unsolved mysteries. And why are we starting there?
For me, it was kind of getting everyone on the same page because a lot of people around here are seeing the Unsolved Mysteries episode. A lot of people who, you know, watched the show back in the day have seen it, might not remember it, but that information is out there. That stuff is out in the wild. You can go on YouTube and watch it. And so I thought it'd be good to start off by making sure that everyone is coming into this case with kind of the same sort of generalized information about it. And also, the TV show matters. It did impact the direction of this case. It did impact the way things unfolded later. And understanding how that dynamic played out, I think, is a key part of this case.
Well, yeah, I do wonder how many of the actual participants in the case and in the trials, because the trials were so much later, actually saw the Unsolved Mysteries. I mean, obviously, one of the investigators seems to mention that you interviewed. Do you have any idea how many people who were actually involved with the case actually saw that?
A lot of them have, but not as many as you'd think. I'd say probably maybe slightly more have than have not. But there were people who were closely involved in the events who maybe intentionally just didn't want to see it.
Well, I have to say I was a big fan of Unsolved Mysteries back in the day. And I, too, sort of bought into the authenticity of it, you know, that they made the effort to include the actual locations and they would have people who actually experienced the crime in the actual recreations. Of course, in retrospect, I go, oh, my God, that must have been awful for these people. You know, they're horribly re-traumatized by this situation. But at the time, I totally bought into it like everybody else.
Yeah, I don't know if it's, I think it's obviously in some cases, it's, I mean, I like the fact they did that, at least having it in the actual location, maybe not using the actual evidence. But as we were doing this, I mean, I realized like these people who had gone through something very traumatic and with no real recognition in the fact that it was trauma and probably ought to have had therapy for it, are asked to like relive these events. that they went through. And I think I can only imagine how many episodes of Unsolved Mysteries did inflict some kind of new wounds on the people involved. But I don't think that's necessarily a reason for them to have not done it that way.
I watch Unsolved Mysteries all the time growing up, but I completely forgot that that was part of it, that to the extent possible, they used the actual people involved in the crime scene. And now, as I was, you know, listening to the clips and it came back, I was like, that's kind of crazy. It's fine, I think, to use the actual locations, but to actually ask the people who lived through it to, can you just kind of reenact that for, I thought that was, I don't think it would happen today, because I think people would be a lot more sensitive to like what that could do. But I also wondered about like some of the choices they made in terms of like the changes they made. Now, not everything was completely true to what happened. And some of it seemed like insignificant, like where the couple was seated in the church. Why would they change that? I didn't understand that. Susan, do you know why they did that?
I don't know exactly, because there were some significant inaccuracies in what Unsolved Mysteries had on on the show. But at the same time, they're not really investigators. They're dependent here on what law enforcement is telling them. So if the information they're getting from law enforcement was wrong, well, the information on the show is going to be wrong.
Got it.
Or in some cases, the people, we don't know the exact facts. We don't know every detail. So maybe they were forced to
fill it in. Yeah.
You know, read between the lines and be like, well, we have two different accounts here. Let's try and do it this way.
Well, as a producer, I totally understand the issue. Every single artistic choice they make reflects something about the recreation. So like, you know, every bit of clothing somebody wears, every position that somebody's standing in, and they have to make all of these judgments on the fly while they're shooting something with a limited budget, you know, and a limited amount of time. And one thing I thought actually, Susan, that you mentioned that was very astute was noticing that the camera angle was clearly meant to indicate that this was the assailant creeping up on the church. Because even a choice like that, like whether you use a locked off camera or something that's handheld, indicates something to the viewer.
Yeah. They never actually explain that part in the episode, which is interesting because they also show that camera creeping around the side of the church to cut the phone lines. But if you didn't know that's like how it went down, I'm not sure you'd necessarily pick up on that from the camera stuff. But if you know the case facts, I kind of like how it was done. But like you were saying, there's a lot of stuff they must have had to choose on the fly here. I remember one part when they have Harold Swain just talking in the background and he says like, now, Sister Brenda, can you do this for us? Well, there was no Brenda in the meeting.
Yeah. Again, the actor was probably saying, I got to say something here. Can somebody throw me something? You know, I mean, I'm serious. That's the way it happens a lot of the time. An actor says, you know, I feel stupid standing here. Can I be writing on a clipboard? It's like, oh, OK, well, you're writing on a clipboard. But the guy didn't really have a clipboard when the incident occurred. So, you know, I empathize with producers and directors having to make a lot of choices in a very compact area of time. But it does impact on how the case is perceived. I mean, I heard the actor giving a very ominous reading of, I want to talk to him, you know, and again, who knows what the actual perpetrator said at that time, or if they said it with that tone.
So the words were right. The words were actually, they're pretty faithful to what the testimony and accounts we have, which are pretty consistent for that little exchange. But the tone did sound more menacing when at the time, it does not seem like the woman who went outside named Vanzola Williams felt particularly alarmed by him. She may have been a bit creeped out, but there was no overt sort of threateningness to him. Although I was also reading about the production of Unsolved Mysteries, and there was some comment somewhere about how you could always tell how good of actors the witnesses and law enforcement officers turned out to be by how much narration the episode had. if they were all shitty actors, they just like had Robert Stack smooth it over with like talking over the whole thing. But if they actually were decently, you know, not atrocious, then they'd actually have more of the reenactment included.
Yeah, there's all kinds of tricks like that when you're in production. Narration is a huge fallback. Also, those talking head interview things. Very often you'll just have Robert Stack say something to patch up a big plot hole that you've got, you know. One thing, though, that I do think is valuable is getting those in-person interviews at that time. You know, obviously, having the people on camera relating things, that's, I think, the best possible way to record those kind of interviews.
I asked you at one point, John, if you thought there'd be any chance of getting the unaired, the full footage of those interviews. that they've done. And I think you said, like, not a chance in hell. Or
yes, pretty much. Yeah, because when you're in production on a show, you keep stuff for, you know, until the show is locked. Once the show is locked, you really have no need to keep the stuff, but you do need to reuse the media a lot of the time. So you've got to record over the hard drives and stuff like that. Back then, it was probably actually on videotape, but the videotape took up huge amounts of storage space. So again, you know, keeping it cost money. And if anything that costs money over a length of time just won't keep happening. It just won't.
But the information, how can you throw it away like that?
Yes, Susan has called herself an information hoarder, pretty much. I think that explains a lot about you, Susan, actually.
I can't delete anything. I just keep getting bigger hard drives, and it's ridiculous. I know I'm never going to touch most of that stuff. And, like, old cases, I can't do it. Even when I know there's no chance in hell I'm going to use it again.
I finally put all of the non-stuff on a cloud server just a few weeks ago because I was like, I don't know, like psychologically, it was really hard to let go.
But you have to figure that when somebody writes your life story, Susan, Rabia, Colin, they will have access, you know, you're long dead and they just look, you know, they can go through your entire digital life and know everything about you. Everything. You know, you got to figure that'll be very helpful to your autobiographer. Well, not your autobiographer, your biographer, that is.
I'm burning everything.
Yeah. She's a data hoarder until death. Then then it gets exploded.
A dream is just a great idea that doesn't have a website yet. Make it a reality with Squarespace. With Squarespace, you can create a beautiful website to turn your cool idea into a new website, showcase your work, blog or publish content, sell products and services of all kinds, promote your physical or online business, or announce an upcoming event or special project. Let's say you want to create a website about the use of arsenic in Turkey medication, or a website about all the cases in which prosecutors have forced defendants to waive away the right to appeal, or a website about all the true crime cases covered on Unsolved Mysteries. Squarespace has got you covered. They offer beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, the ability to customize look and feel as well as settings, products, and more with just a few clicks, everything optimized for mobile right out of the box, a new way to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions, analytics that help you grow in real time, built-in search engine optimization, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. So head to squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
So did you actually get to talk with any of the people who actually participated in the Unsolved Mysteries interviews?
Vanzoli Williams is deceased. She died a few years back. But other than that, I've spoken to everyone on the show, I believe.
Oh, so you do have access to, in terms of people who were there when it was actually shot, so you know what their experience was like.
Yeah. I wanted to start with their original, not testimony, but the closest thing we have to recorded testimony, the original statements from, you know, 3 years after this crime happened. But they're still around, and I have spoken to them.
So I wanted to ask, how did this case come to your attention?
Georgia Innocence Project is representing Dennis Perry, and they had some activity in the case a few years back. And when we did Joy Watkins' case, they mentioned it to me, so I was kind of aware of it. And Claire was trying to like sell us on it by like talking about how good the case it was and how they had all this audio. And I was interested, but I also kind of wanted, I was thinking I wanted to move out of Georgia, like go somewhere new, and I do. But the more I learned about it, the more I realized it was the perfect case to cover. Although I will say that Claire was a little bit misleading about the amount of audio. There was a ton of audio in the case at one time. It turns out that somewhere along the way, almost all of it got lost.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to hear that. Mm-hmm. But now, do you think, is there something just about Georgia criminal justice that we just keep coming back here after the Joey Watkins case?
You know, it's not just our show. I think there's probably, three or four other, you know, fairly prominent podcasts in this genre that are based out of Georgia. I don't know if that's just coincidence or if it's because there's just some set of factors that came together to make it a fertile ground for a podcast. But there's like Breakdown, which is also covers a lot of problems in the criminal justice system. There's Up and Vanished. There's non criminal justice theme shows that are true crime set here. So obviously there's something going on that seems to appeal to storytellers.
It looks lovely. I mean, if you go to visit, it seems nice. There's no reason to think that they're in the midst of a wrongful conviction wave. But, you know, it's proven pretty fascinating for us to delve into. Now, I had a question, and perhaps you'll actually get into this as we go deeper into the series. But why was the case reopened in 1998? Is that something you'll answer later, or is that something you can answer now?
I'm not sure I'm able entirely to answer it now. I hope to find more out about that. But for whatever reason, or at least the official version of the story, they just decided it was time to reopen it.
Yeah, that just sounds a little, I don't know, it doesn't pass the sniff test with me. I mean, you know, but then again, I guess we'll find out later on what bunch of events might have possibly led up to that.
Was it a situation where they just got funding to, like, look back at cold cases in general and this was one of them, or was it specifically?
Oh, no. It was this, that part, there's definitely more to come on, but there was specific funding that was made available for this case and this case only.
Oh, interesting.
Intriguing. I can't wait to listen to further episodes. Oh, and here's another thing you might be able to get into in further episodes, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You know, there was a little bit of this on social media, and this was the first thing that jumped out at me was, how is it legal for a prosecutor to ask that somebody give up their appellate options? I mean, especially if you're looking at a life sentence, I mean, that feels like coercion. Is that something we're going to get into on the show?
Yes, because I legally and morally and just in terms of what the law ought to be, that's a huge discussion to be had. And I remember first looking at this case, my gut instinct was, wait, they can't do that, right? And theoretically, I do this kind of stuff, I should know. I mean, yes, you can do this. There is no constitutional right to an appeal. There's no constitutional protection to ever have an appeal, just the trial. So yeah, you can totally do this right now.
Yeah, and it's more common, it's a big issue in plea bargains, where a lot of plea bargains nowadays have these waivers of appellate rights, and that's being litigated sort of across the country as to the extent to which you can waive those rights, and so we'll definitely delve in more detail into that subject later.
I mean, theoretically, there is right now not a limit on what this can put a stop to later reopening. If you literally prove that the whole case had been fabricated by the prosecutor one night writing on his laptop saying, I'm making some evidence up, here we go, and didn't tell you till after this happened, doesn't matter, you're out of luck. So it's a very broad waiver.
Oh my gosh. I mean, because that totally affects the context in which you sign the waiver. I mean, if you have no expectation of fairness because the prosecutor's already fabricated evidence and done, you know, gotten away with ridiculous things, how are you supposed to make that judgment at that time?
It's a good question.
So I've heard that there have been some things happening in the Joey Watkins case, and I was hoping you guys could update us.
Yes, unfortunately. So as we've mentioned earlier, Joey has his habeas proceeding. It's up in Walker County. And before he can actually get to the merits of his habeas, there's a procedural challenge. The state of Georgia challenged it and sought to have his habeas dismissed on the grounds that it was untimely. So there's a hearing on that issue and that issue alone. And we had been waiting for the judge's ruling, not that long. It was just like 2 months ago. And recently we got the ruling back, and the judge determined that Joey Watkins' motion was untimely and dismissed it.
So does that mean that these things can't be addressed at all?
Well, in the trial court right now. So the next step, unfortunately, has to go back to the Supreme Court of Georgia. And that will be another year and a half to go through. You know, I'll admit I'm surprised. I did not expect this. I don't like getting optimistic about court proceedings, and certainly not in this kind of case. But I felt good that procedurally, at least in terms of getting to the merits, I thought that Joey would win. I was wrong. I just didn't see how a judge would decide that he couldn't bring these claims. Now, to break that down, what the judge actually found is that because Joey brought these claims many years after his trial and not back in 2003, they're barred under the law. What that means now is that, quote, the court finds that the factual and legal basis for his current claims were available at the time he litigated his first petition, and as such, the petition is successive. All of the claims now asserted by petitioner could reasonably have been raised in a prior petition, as the facts and law on which they were based were in existence then. What this means now, the claim that Joey brought involving the dog evidence, where the prosecutor told the judge in court that no bullet had been recovered, that no ballistics evidence existed, when in fact that ballistic evidence did exist. It did not match the murder weapon and was not connected to the state's theory of the crime, the fact that the state said something untrue and looks like a lie to the court and to the defense is not something that can excuse Joey's failure to realize that at the time. In other words, if the prosecutor lies about evidence and hides it, and you don't find it within a year or two, sorry, sucker, you're out of luck.
Well, that's transparently ridiculous.
Yeah. And on the juror issue, it's even, well, there's also problems there, because the conclusion was that Joey Watkins, and now when I say Joey Watkins, what I mean is the theoretical concept Joey Watkins threw his attorneys, mm-hmm. could have contacted jurors at, you know, right after the trial. So the fact no one realized for many years until a reporter came along and talked to a juror that there was a problem, well, that's Joey Watkins' fault, and he can't bring any claims. So yeah, I did not expect this to happen. Colin, you've looked into this some. What are some of the practical problems here from this ruling?
Yeah, this is a huge issue, and the issue is essentially this. We have this rule, it's a rule of evidence, Federal Rule of Evidence 606B and their state counterparts, and that says after jurors have entered a verdict, generally those jurors are not allowed to come into court and impeach that verdict, meaning come in and say, I engaged in misconduct, such as doing a drive test myself. However, there are exceptions to this, which say if there's extraneous prejudicial information or someone was tampering with the jury, then those jurors can come in. There's the case out of Georgia, it's the Turpin case, and what that says is essentially you are allowed to bring these claims years later because we don't want attorneys to harass jurors. And so generally attorneys and appeals are not allowed to contact jurors if somehow a third party like a journalist like Susan comes forward and is able to speak with a juror and uncover misconduct. You're supposed to be able to present that. And so the collateral consequence I see if this order is upheld is any attorney in Georgia in any case is going to start contacting every single juror in that trial. And that's generally not allowed. And it's something that the courts and the legislatures don't want. And so, yeah, I really disagree strongly with this ruling as an evidence professor. And I think there's strong grounding both in Georgia. There's a recent Supreme Court opinion. There are ABA model rules that I think all speak in support of saying this is a claim that Joey Watkins should be able to bring.
Yeah. And the Constitution and the case law do not hold that the rule is the prosecutor can hide and the defendant must seek. And which is what this order is. It says flat out, if a prosecutor lies to the court and hides evidence in order to increase its ability to convict a defendant, it is the defendant's job to know and recognize when the prosecutor is lying.
And to be able to find it from jail.
And to find it instantly within a couple years, which means that essentially it would require for due diligence for, you know, diligent appellate and habeas attorneys in Georgia, for any case, they have to reinvestigate everything from the start. I mean, literally everything. If you assume the prosecutor said a fact and you assume it's true, well, you're out of luck if it wasn't true and you didn't check into it. So everything that the prosecutor claims, you got to reinvestigate. Every witness, you got to re-interview. There's literally nothing you don't have to redo in the case to bring any kind of appeal or habeas without forfeiting that claim.
And all the prosecutor has to do is, it basically just hold out long enough. If they can hide it long enough, then he's out of luck.
I just feel like
it gives it incentivizes, you know, them from basically not turning over stuff. Like, you know, when we're investigating cases, we're always doing like these FOIA type requests, you know, public information requests. If you just wait long enough, then oh well.
And keep in mind what the evidence in this case actually is. The dog claim was about evidence that was obtained by the Floyd County Police Department, sent to the GBI, to their evidence division, was extracted by the GBI, was handed over to prosecutors in the Floyd County Police Department. But that was all done under a new secret case number that was never disclosed to the defense. So every request for information, every request that's been done in all the time between when this all happened and when Claire found it, came back without anything about the dog evidence because it just wasn't there. It's only because Claire, by some fluke of luck, was able to track down one expert from the GBI who gave us a name. We found the guy, tracked him down. Through this whole sequence of events, we finally found the guy who is retired now, but had done the dog autopsy, and just by chance happened to have an old stack of his list of his cases in his closet somewhere. And he pulled it out, found the dog autopsy, found the case number, sent it back to us, and lo and behold, it was not the case number we knew for the case. So only then, after requesting that case number, did we get the dog evidence. Now that, apparently, is Joey Watkins' fault. for not having done from prison in like the year after he was convicted.
I've always found courts requiring things happening in timely manners just incredibly ironic, only because courts yeah. take forever, but it's just one way. You know, it's like if you don't have it in, you know, by this time you're in real trouble, but we're going to take as long as we friggin' feel like. Just it feels like a ridiculous double standard. I understand that, you know, courts have enormous workloads and they're doing their best to work through it. But OK, then extend that same understanding to the people presenting the defense.
Yeah. I mean, the courts can't function without these time requirements in place. And I'm not saying at all that we shouldn't have time limits of some sorts, because that you know, keeps the courts going around. But in cases where fundamental justice is at issue, to make such, like, one, to have the deadlines, and two, have them on such short time frames for evidence of innocence and for prosecutorial wrongdoing to come in or never come in at all, that's a system that's designed to achieve injustice. It's not a system that's designed to fix its mistakes.
Yeah, and, you know, in terms of what Susan was mentioning about pessimism versus optimism, yeah, I, as you just mentioned, John, you would think that given the extreme delays that occur in these cases of appeals, you would think that the court would afford some protection to defendants, but there's reason to believe that in this case, as in other cases, the Supreme Court of Georgia might say, oh, you know, we're okay with it. We're okay with these time limits. That's a bit unfair. But it's my firm belief in terms of optimism to say they're not going to want to expose jurors in every case in Georgia to attorneys contact them and grilling them about what they did in the case. And so that's my glimmer of hope, is I think the Supreme Court of Georgia is going to say we can't let this stand and is going to agree to hear the case.
Well, that was my question, is that does Georgia Innocence Project now just appeal this up to the Supreme Court of Georgia directly, or are there interim steps?
It's straight up to the Supreme Court of Georgia. And they've got, I forget how much time left, but it was 30 days from whenever the order was entered. So before too long, that'll come in. And I know they're hoping that they can find support and amicus briefs to be written in support of these issues, and are looking for that. And I do still, despite the fact that I was shocked by this ruling, I feel optimistic, just because this is not about Joey. It's not about Joey Watkins. This order is going to cause like the biggest pain in the ass to the system, and that they'll want to correct. I mean, it would just be a ongoing headache for everyone, or at least all the defense people in Georgia. And I don't think that they're going to be able to function that way.
How are Joey's spirits at this time?
Honestly, not. I've never seen it. I saw him yesterday, and it was hard. It was really hard. He's not had an easy time lately for a lot of reasons. And yeah, no, he's going through a really hard time right now.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Whenever I hear about these, you know, the various steps of court, I just wonder if people in prison, if they ever allow themselves to feel hopeful. You know, I mean, how treacherous that must be. You know, I'm sure Adnan goes through a lot of that as well. It's like, you know, I'm sure his religion brings him an awful lot of peace about that. But my heart just bleeds for people who have to have that hope yanked out from them constantly.
Joey told me before this, when I was optimistic that it would go well, he said, I've never won a motion, ever. And he hasn't. But I'm like, well, eventually it's going to start having to give. And his losing streak hasn't changed.
You see, I still feel like the bias on judges is still something that has not really been explored, because everybody comes at things, every human being comes at things with bias. And I'm certain that the institutional bias towards, you know, confirming the case is closed and, you know, and this is all closure, and that whole thing weighs heavily on judges. So you just think, well, you have to hope that they get lucky at some point. And that's crazy to me that you're left hoping that they just luck out and happen to get a judge who isn't subject to that much bias.
I don't think there are judges who aren't. I mean, that's just part of the job. There's no way of avoiding it. The question is, how do we counteract it from causing, you know, unjust rulings? But judges are judges. They work in the system. They're in court every day. They see prosecutors every day. These are their colleagues or coworkers. And there's just an institutional inertia towards protecting that system. And I don't think it's about the judges necessarily. Like, you can be the most well-intentioned judge in the world, but that bias might still affect your decision without you realizing it.
Well, yeah, it seems like if a judge wants to dismiss something on the untimely thing sounds like almost a technicality to me. I feel like judges can always dismiss things on technicality. You delve into anything and there's always something you can find. My point is, I hope that becomes an aspect of legal training in the U.S. I mean, Colin, is that dealt with, the psychology of bias, is that dealt with in law school?
No, there's not at all.
Not what I was
like. That's a nice idea, but no.
There are some other legal systems internationally. Germany is the main one where essentially after a person graduates from law school, they cycle. I think it's among all three, but like judge for a while, prosecutor for a while, defense counsel. And so they get to see all perspectives and all sides of the issue. And I think something like that is interesting if we could implement it here, because I think that getting that different perspective is something that you don't get in law schools, as we just mentioned, and lets you see, oh, okay, I understand what defense counsel is going through. I understand what the prosecutor is going through.
I know that there are CLE classes that are offered. I've, in fact, given one myself on the issue of bias in the criminal justice system. But in law school itself, I mean, it'd be interesting to hear if there is a law school out there that has made it part of the curriculum anywhere. If there is, let us know.
And there's really not a class. There's not a class on being a judge, really. I mean, that's not something that's addressed at all. And I guess.
Yeah, but that'd be like to be really ballsy as a law student to be like, I'm going to take a class and have
to
judge.
Well, I mean, like, well, you can apply for administrative law, you know, judge positions. Certain, you know, so there might be people who think of it as a career track in that sense. But yeah, that would be weird.
There should be an academy. There should be an academy. Judge it's like academy. Starfleet Academy.
There actually, exactly. I think there is. For certain judgeships, there are. I think it's like a 2-week or 4-week. It's a very short. I was just reading about it the other day, and I think it was about, at least for the immigration judges, like because of everything that's happening right now, they get like 2 to 4 weeks of training before they're just sent out there, which is really not enough. But
see, that astonishes me because, you know, we've talked about police officers get, what, 6 months? You know, you talk about judges getting 4 weeks. I mean, that's summer camp. That's yeah. Nothing. You know, meanwhile, by the way, hairstylists, you got to 3 years. 3 years of study to be a hairstylist. Don't get me wrong. I'm in a business where that matters a great mm-hmm. deal. So I get that. I get the import there. See, this is totally shocking news to me that there isn't any formal training for judges. I mean, so the idea is that you become such a good lawyer that you just step up and the next step up is judge. Is that how it works?
Kind of.
But I mean, you guys, you people think for a
you're
living.
You're dabble in your robe. Just
yeah, exactly.
I mean, some judgeships are, some judges are elected, some positions are elected, some are appointed, and some are by merit, depending on the kind of judgeship you're talking about. So,
I mean, technically, you don't even need to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I think that's what I have to do now. Ducky has to go to the Supreme Court and give a little bit of balance.
Nothing's stopping you.
No, I know. Nothing. Exactly.
Susan, I have a question about Joey's case. Do they have to now file cert before, you know, an actual appeal? I mean, is that what's next, or can they file a direct appeal on this?
No, I believe they're seeking cert.
They have to seek cert. Okay. So that also could be denied. I mean, yeah. God forbid. Okay.
The end.
And they could go to federal court. So there's still that option.
Mm. It's not the end, but it'd be the end of that path.
Well, I wanted to get to some social media questions, if that's okay with you guys. We got one from Sakura Craigie, who says, wow, what an interesting case. I can't wait to hear more. Already, I'm seeing red flags, the biggest one being this. According to the state, Dennis Perry killed Deacon Swain because Swain had mocked him for being poor. But according to the people who knew him, and this is in the Unsolved Mysteries episode, Deacon Swain would give you his last dime and the shirt off his back if you asked for it. That doesn't sound like the kind of person who would make fun of people for being poor. The state's portrait of Swain is completely at odds with the descriptions of those who knew him best, a good Christian man who provided free meals and other assistance to anyone who came to the church in need. Yeah, that seemed like a glaring thing, like that the state's theory depended on something that virtually nobody would support this guy actually doing.
it is, and it's never addressed. I think there's an underlying pretext of perhaps Dennis Perry just made the whole thing up, or was like delusional or overly sensitive, or somehow was not being truthful about what Harold Swain had done. But it's otherwise never addressed. And yeah, from everything I've heard about Harold Swain, the scenario that is the heart of the state's, you know, motive here, it doesn't add up.
Yeah, I had another question about the state's thing, and maybe perhaps this was dealt with at some point. But if the meetings weren't always held at the church, and Harold wasn't even usually at the meetings, how would Dennis Perry have possibly known to find him there to confront him?
Yeah, that's never addressed.
Oh, so the state didn't wave a red flag and say, no, he was going there in the hopes of finding him, or, you know, he was going to wait until he showed up or something.
Never came up, never brought up, just, you know, somehow, magically, he knew.
I am dumbfounded, because that seems like a huge, huge hole. We got another question from Andrew Young. It says, very interesting first episode. Watch the Unsolved Mysteries episode on YouTube, season 1, episode 4. The same episode where they, rather preposterously, in my opinion, theorized that the Son of Sam killer was actually just one person in a secret group of organized crime killers. Anyway, was wondering if anyone knew how the Undisclosed team heard about this case. Obviously, we got to that. Was it from watching the episode of Unsolved Mysteries?
You know, so watching the whole episode from what the Slain Swain incident came from actually answered a question I had, because a few of the tips that were called in were like, I think Son of Sam killed the Swains. I'm like, what the hell? I'm like, how? And then I realized they had that part on the show. So obviously someone saw that and then decided that Son of Sam killed everyone else.
Well, that, by the way, there were three segments on every show. So that was one thing that occurred to me, was that when they had to shoot these segments, they had very little time, because they've got three different locations they've got to do things in, you know, tell three completely different stories, do all the interviews. Again, I'll be amazed if any of these recreations are anything close to what actually occurred.
Yeah, this could be the next few seasons, just going into all
the Unsolved Mysteries. that's another podcast. Let's do that.
Yeah, but one thing I kept wondering watching the Unsolved Mysteries episode here is, like, had I seen it before? Because I can't tell if, like, I'm just, maybe Unsolved Mysteries are so similar in certain ways that I just feel like I've watched it before. But the first time I saw it, in the back of my head, I'm like, wait, I think I may have seen this on TV at some point.
I definitely saw it. Yeah, I mean, really? I watched definitely that first season of Unsolved Mysteries, and it did ring somewhat of a bell. It was very foggy, but yeah, I did definitely see it back in the 80s.
But you know what I've forgotten is how much crazy conspiracy bullshit is actually on Unsolved Mysteries. It's not just true crime. It's like Shroud of Turin. Is it real?
Well, yeah, there was, remember, In Search Of, there was a whole bunch of shows then that really played up. It was in the zeitgeist. You know, everybody was kind of questioning after Watergate. Everybody was questioning authority and
UFOs.
Yes, exactly. It was super fun. I mean, I watched Close Encounters of the Third Kind again recently, and it's a beautifully made Spielberg movie, but it's all about UFOs. And I was trying to show it to my son. And my son was like, who cares about UFOs? there was no mystery to him whatsoever. It was not spellbinding in any way, shape, or form. But it was very popular at the time.
They're just lights in the sky. Why are we watching this?
Exactly. Who cares? Actually, we got a really interesting question here from Free Read and Write, who says, do any of you have thoughts on the ancestry DNA method used to catch the Golden State Killer and possibly Fourth Amendment implications? Because obviously, if some hair was found on the glasses that could implicate who the killer was, could the use of familial DNA be appropriate here?
Maybe. I was talking about this recently with someone. So the DNA that was found on those hairs is mitochondrial DNA. It's not the standard DNA you get from that you usually hear about. It's not the kind that's in the database. There's no system right now that I'm aware of. I don't think there's any system at all of mitochondrial DNA that you can check for in criminal law enforcement databases. So that there's nowhere you can plug in this DNA profile we have and find the killer. However, they've kind of discontinued it, but some of those, like Ancestry.com and like 23andMe, whatever websites, some of them did initially use mitochondrial DNA for like family charting to, you know, find family relationships. So theoretically, it might work here, but that's something to look into.
Well, I know that the police in the Golden State Killer case specifically didn't use Ancestry or 23andMe because they have specific policies about it. But there are apparently other DNA repositories that work in a different way and clearly have a much more cavalier attitude about letting people submit things. But I also wanted to talk about – a lot of people talk about the privacy implications. And I was curious, Colin, could you chime in on those? People always say, well, there's privacy implications. And I think, well, what are they?
Yeah, well, from a Fourth Amendment perspective, there's likely not any type of challenge. So there's this doctrine known as the third party doctrine. And that says while law enforcement itself is not allowed to collect a lot of data without a warrant or probable cause, if a third party collects it, and then law enforcement goes to that third party, then that is kosher under the Fourth Amendment. Now, there was this recent case, you might have heard of, the Carpenter case, which said the cell tower pings, that's something that actually does require a warrant. But that's something where you're not voluntarily giving that information. It's being collected by the cell phone companies. The 23andMe or Ancestry.com, that's people voluntarily putting their biological information into the system. And so, yeah, there's a bunch of articles written in the wake of Carpenter and the GS Key case that say, yeah, there's no protection under the Fourth Amendment. And a lot of people have proposed, you know, you have like HIPAA laws or you have education privacy laws. People have proposed having laws to cover that whole cottage industry. But right now, it's the Wild West. I mean, law enforcement can go in and collect that. And right now, they don't need a warrant or even probable cause to get that information.
I'm guessing right now, law enforcement is doing as much as they can before it all gets shut down. But, you know, another case that I read about this past week, which is really interesting, which is a slightly different use of the DNA stuff, is the Linda O'Keefe murder from more than 40 years ago. I don't know if you guys caught this, but there's a police agency, I think there's a Newport Beach police, that did a whole Twitter thread on this cold case from more than 40 years ago. They had some DNA that they never matched anybody, but they, I don't know if I've seen this before, they used that DNA to now create a sketch. Like they were able to create some kind of a physical profile of, according from this DNA, we have determined that this guy is going to have these traits. Like his eye color is going to be this, his hair is going to be this, his face. And I've never seen that done where, which I think is, I mean, I don't see why it would, I mean, there wouldn't be the same kind of privacy implications. But if they are able to like recreate somebody's face from the DNA, I think that's fascinating. Did you guys see this?
No, I did not see this.
I saw it. I'm very skeptical about how accurate it really is.
That I wonder too. I mean, just, but theoretically, I mean, I feel like at least some of the things should be.
Gattaca.
I mean, should be possible.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a tool. It's not evidence, but it's a tool. You know, it's like profiling. It's right. Not evidence. It's just, it hopefully will help you hone the search because the search is too big, you know. But I had not heard that. And obviously, whenever you hear something, some huge technical leap like that, you get scared. That's my default. I don't know about you folks, but I become frightened. And I was trying to think, you know, what if familial DNA was used and some horrible killer was somebody in my family? Because I went through Ancestry, as a matter of fact, because I did a TV show called Who Do You Think You Are, where they trace your ancestors back. But I did think, you know, you really have to be prepared for the bad stuff. Because it could be there. It was interesting. They did the episode on my 9 times great-grandfather who was captured in the English Civil War and was sold into indentured servitude here in North America. And I thought, wow, that's fascinating. And I joked during the show about having a Mayflower ancestor. And it turns out I did have a Mayflower ancestor. They just didn't want to do a show about him because he was such a screw-up. And he was on the Mayflower. He was an indentured servant on the Mayflower. And when he got to the States, he immediately became one of the states, well, one of North America's first criminals, basically.
He participated. That show.
I know. He participated in the first duel in New England. By the way, both sides lost. Both go, they shot each other and both survived their wounds. So,
So why first in New England, not first in America? They had records show.
Good point, because I guess New England, was it officially a colony at that point? It was not. You're right. It would be the first duel in North America. Way to go.
Unless there was like Jamestown had some duels or something.
Oh, okay. That's a good point.
Yeah, good point. But at any rate, he was a screw up in whatever rudimentary court the Pilgrims put together. He was in it 23 times. Wow. So my interest in court proceedings goes way back genetically. that's what I'm going to say. At any rate, I certainly think it's worth a try. That thing you mentioned, Rabia, is kind of mind blowing. We've got one last question from social media. This is from Mary Beth Arbogast, who says, being from South Georgia, small town political family dynasties are nothing new to me. From an outsider's perspective, what's your reaction to hearing that the Camden County Sheriff position stayed in the family for the better part of a century? And did that contribute to the miscarriage of justice for Swains and Perry?
To people from here, it doesn't seem weird. To people from not here, it seems pretty damn weird. It's not uncommon, though, for this sort of like political dynasty to exist in southern towns. From counties I'm familiar with up north, there are definitely families that, you know, have the DEA position. They have, you know, chief of police. But usually I'm used to seeing it more rotate around, not three generations in the same position of power. And one is as powerful as the sheriff. For, like they said, most of a century, it was Sheriff Smith of one of three in power.
Yeah, it bumped me a little when I heard it, but I just think dynasties happen everywhere. I mean, we throw elected office at every Kennedy that comes out, you know? I mean, we just...
I think that it's not necessarily, like, you know, it's... I'm not going to say that it's wrong, quote-unquote, or a problem, because it's not uncommon in not just Georgia, but in the South, I'm sure in the North, too. But I do think it does... It absolutely creates dynamics and just... The pattern of life in the community is shaped around this dynamic of the Sheriff Smith's legacy. And it absolutely affected how the Swain case was handled, later how the Perry case was handled. But whether that was for good or ill depends on your position.
Well, I was curious. It sounded like they brought in the GBI right away. So I was curious why the GBI didn't just take over the investigation completely.
So GBI is only there to assist, basically. Like the small town sheriff's departments, police departments usually don't have experience with like forensics and really brutal, strange homicides. So that's what the GBI is there for, to come and assist and to help with that sort of thing. But they don't take it over. They're there to, you know, play wingman, not to be lead.
And do you feel like the GBI handled the investigation well, considering that they were coming into a situation where the sheriffs would have very little experience?
That's a complicated question because there's not like a monolithic GBI here. The GBI was definitely vital to the investigation. And for basically any crime like this in this, like most of the rural South, rural Georgia, you need the GBI there. They're the ones who have to do this because they're the ones who know how. So they did that role here. And there's without them, it would have been a much worse scenario.
Well, thank you guys for joining me on this first addendum of the new season. I'm totally intrigued by the story, and I'm very much looking forward to delving into it with you guys. Thank you guys for making time for me today. Thank you, Susan, for giving us so much background on the case. And if you could you please communicate to Joey that our thoughts are with him, and I'm so sorry for this setback, but, you know, obviously the struggle will continue.
Yeah. I know the support from everyone who's listened to the show means a lot to him.
Well, we're thinking of you, Joey. So I wanted to make a little announcement. We're going to be doing things a little differently this time. I'm going to be shooting a film up in upstate New York for a couple of weeks, so the addenda will not be every week in this series. We have a lot of story to lay out, so we'll be doing episodes on a kind of as-needed basis. But don't worry, we'll always let you know when an addendum episode is coming up, so you can submit your listener questions. But that is it for this first addendum of Season 3. If you feel like checking out our website, it is undisclosed-podcast.com. There's a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to, but I am going to be donating my fees to the Georgia Innocence Project once again. You can find them on the web at georgiainnocenceproject.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I want to thank my assistant, Andrew Cogden, once again. Good questions, dude. Also, thanking Hannah McCarthy of Partners in Crime Media for audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and thank you to Meethal Telhan for managing this gorgeous luxury liner that is the Undisclosed Addendum. Thank you for being the captain of our ship and steering us clear of the icebergs. Hope you have a great couple of weeks, and I will be back when I'm done shooting this thing. Thanks.